Stu Does America.
We are adding to the family here at Stu Does America. We're adding something. Well, you remember that scene from Alien when you know the alien comes out of the chest and then there's the person and the alien? It's not going to be anything like that. It's going to be more like Spaceballs, the parody scene of that scene where the alien comes out and does the dance and says, "Hello, my baby. Hello, my daughter." That's going to be the new thing. It's Stu and Dave Do America right here on Blaze TV. I think it starts the first week of April. Don't quote me on that, but that's what we think. Daniel Horowitz is going to join us here in just a second with the latest on Elizabeth Warren's insane housing bill. Got a few Oscar thoughts, predictions for you before the award ceremony on Sunday. But we're going to start by doing predictions and primaries. And as you may know, I have another show starting in April as well, called Predictable with Stu. And we will be going through prediction market stuff. We'll hit stuff like the Oscars. We're going to be doing some stuff on that on the website, predictableshow.com, as we lead up to that event on Sunday. Not because necessarily you care about any of the Oscar winners, but maybe some possibilities to turn a little bit of money into a little bit more money. So we'll look at those possibilities. But one of the things, the main thing we're going to be doing over at predictableshow.com and on the new show is going to be related to prediction markets and how they deal with the elections. This is a huge thing. I've been talking about this for a while. You may know I did a whole election model last election cycle that correctly predicted the outcome of the election. But it's one of those things that we have to look at this and say, where are we right now? And we have to be honest with ourselves, because it's important to note when things aren't going so well, just as much as it's great to celebrate when they are going well. Right now, there are definitely some signs that things don't look great for the 2026 election. Let me give you some of those. To win back the House, Democrats take the fight to deep red areas. Across the country, Democrats are trying to take back control of Congress and have been scouring and scouting and recruiting candidates with compelling biographies to compete in seemingly lopsided red regions with remarkable success. Some of the Democratic expansion strategy is driven by necessity. There are fewer competitive seats in America, but a series of stronger than expected performances in special elections, most recently a Texas Senate race, it was a Texas state Senate race actually, has left party strategists emboldened. Now, look, special elections don't tell you all that much about what's coming. They can give you hints. They can give you bits and pieces of information. They don't always tell you what the trend's going to be. Obviously, massive things are going to change. I mean, a few weeks ago, we weren't at war, and now we are, right? Who knows what that's going to mean, the polls. It could be a situation where something terrible happens and the people of the United States rally around the president and his party. Could be the opposite. Things could go really poorly and people could run away and it could be a catastrophe for Republicans. None of these things are known this far out. We can only project with what we understand. But I will say, the fact that Democrats are spending money in these districts that are usually bright red is an indication of, A, their belief that they can be competitive in places they aren't normally competitive, and B, could be an indication that they are maybe getting a little too big for their britches, right? It could be the type of thing where they're investing money in places like that instead of going to places that they are more sensibly going to be competitive. Let me give you some of these special elections that they're talking about, because some of them are, I mean, the indications are scary. I will not say this is going to be a definitive factor, but the indications are scary. Democrat wins in Lakes region. Special election for a seat in historically Republican district. Bobby Bowdman narrowly defeated Dale Fincher in a special election for a New Hampshire state representative in Carroll County Tuesday, according to results from the Secretary of State's office. Bowdman, a Democrat, will now represent a historically conservative district encompassing Wolfboro, Ossipee, and Tuftonboro, which are three. I actually have a condo in all three of those places. It's a timeshare. That's how I roll. That favored, by the way, President Trump by 9 percentage points in 2024. Democrats are touting the win as a sign of changing momentum. I don't know if it's changing. It seems like it's been on the Democrat side here for a little bit in these special elections. A 9-point Donald Trump district is basically a purple district, right? It sounds like a wide margin. If we were talking about a popular vote for president, it would be a massive margin. But in one district, 9 points You know, I mean, I would say it's a purple district. That might give you an indication that some of these purple districts might go the Democrats' way. Now, this one's a little bit more concerning, I would say. Georgia Democrat leads vote in Marjorie Taylor Greene's district. Now, you know Marjorie Taylor Greene, of course. It's a little hard to keep track of what side she's on these days. Like, you know, we've seen a lot of back and forth going on with good old MJT. But what I will say about Marjorie Taylor Greene is she was a pretty controversial candidate when she came in for various reasons. And she won largely because she was in a safe Republican district. The question wasn't really whether she was going to win her election. The question was whether she was going to win her primary, because, you know, Republicans, generally speaking, did pretty well in this district. Well, Democrat Sean Harris led Republican Clay Fuller 37-35 with more than 95% of the vote counted. Though if you add up all the totals from all 17 candidates on the ballot, Republicans in total had more votes than Democrats accumulated. The district is a test of whether Democrats can capitalize on fractured Republican primaries, even in strongly conservative districts. The 14th district is the most conservative in Georgia, a place where Trump pulled 68% of the vote in 2024. Democrats shouldn't be winning districts where Republicans were getting 68% of the vote in 2024. Again, if you look at it kind of overall, what you see is, okay, this is one Democrat versus a wide field of Republicans. The Republican vote was split. Maybe it's not that big of a deal. It's not a positive sign, though. And this I will give you. By the way, who's going to win this election? You can see here Clay Fuller's up was up at 95%. So we will see where that goes. But, you know, it could go. It's just, you know, it's again, these are just things to make you say, what are we looking at here? Not indications that will necessarily, I'm not putting my money on stuff based on these elections. I don't think that's the right way to go. But some people are. James Tallarico is beating both Ken Paxton and John Cornyn in the Texas Senate election, according to a poll. Now, again, let me give you the ultimate Stu Does America disclaimer on polls. Polls are not surgical instruments. Polls are blunt instruments. Polls are things that tell you generalities. They don't tell you the specifics you might want to know. And you know what polls say? When you say, well, I want you to tell me who's going to win every race. And you know what polls say? Screw you. I'm not telling you that. What I'm going to do is tell you a generality about this particular matchup. I'm going to tell you it's close. Now, that might not be enough for you. Polls might not be enough for you. Maybe you deserve more. Conducted by a public policy polling showed a Democratic candidate beating Paxton by 2 percentage points, 47-45, Cornyn by 1, 44-43, although there's a larger amount of people who are not sure who they would support in either race. Again, it's a poll. What the poll is telling you is not, well, for sure, the Democrats going to win by 1 or 2 points. What it's telling you is it's pretty close. There were polls that showed Cruz losing to Beto O'Rourke back in the day. You know, he didn't lose to Beto O'Rourke, but it was a closer election, certainly for a Republican in Texas. Paxton seems to currently have the upper hand of the Republican runoff. A new survey conducted by Texas Public Opinion Research shows Paxton gathering 49% of the vote compared to Cornyn's 41% of the vote. Remaining respondents remain undecided. Now, that, of course, is a factor tied to whether Donald Trump is going to endorse or not. He says he will endorse, as I talked about with Sarah Gonzalez earlier this week. Every day he doesn't is another day that the Paxton political life is kept alive. It seems like there's a negotiation going on somewhere behind the scenes between some of the establishment types and Ken Paxton trying to get him to leave the race. And the threat is that Donald Trump would come in and endorse John Cornyn. Now, look, when it comes to policy, there's really no question there. John Cornyn should not be a senator in Texas. He's terrible when it comes to a conservative from Texas. Again, a conservative, he was running as a senator in Maine, he'd be probably fine. The fact that here he is in Texas, where we can have a very conservative person, whether it's Ken Paxton or anybody else, it's kind of ridiculous, honestly, but this is the world we live in. The TPOR poll analyzed how the scenario would change depending on Trump's endorsement. Should he effectively back Cornyn, it wouldn't be enough to get him across the finish line, according to this poll. Paxson would still lead by one. In contrast, though, should the state attorney in general get the endorsement, his support would jump to 58% compared to Cornyn's 32%. So if Paxson gets the endorsement, Paxson runs away with it. If Cornyn gets the endorsement, it goes to about 50, you know, I mean, 50-50. I should just use 44-43, I suppose, when describing that. The point, though, is I will say, if Donald Trump endorses John Cornyn, I don't know that I believe that that poll holds. I think probably what we see there is John Cornyn winning the election, maybe by a lot more than 1 point, maybe more like 10 points. But I don't know. I mean, you know, not every time Donald Trump endorses, most of the time it usually works. It doesn't always work. And, you know, the people of Texas have a really strong opinion on John Cornyn, which is like a very strong, eh. Republicans are like, ugh. And moderates are like, eh. And Democrats are like, ugh. So that analysis aside, basically, people in Texas aren't going to be influenced by an endorsement in this particular race as much as normal from Donald Trump. Though I do think whoever he endorses will win. I do actually think that. By the way, this is what the Texas Senate primary looks like right now. You saw Ken Paxson was up at about 80% before the election. He dropped down very, very low. At one point, I think he was at 9% chance to win this. He's now back up to about 39%. Cornyn was at 91, now back down to 61. As far as who's going to win the actual race, they are saying they believe right now, the markets are telling us there's a 39% chance that James Tallarico is going to be a senator from Texas. Now, that involves a catastrophic disaster for the Republican Party generally. That's what that involves. Or some massive scandal. You know, Ken Paxton wins, and then he's seen, you know, kicking a puppy, right? Like, it's got to be something. It would have to be an incident or a complete collapse of the party. Those are the two scenarios which James Tallarico can win. Like, I think he sucks. You know, they keep trying to put these sort of milquetoast candidates out there on the left to try to win. I don't think it's going to work here. It didn't work with Beto. It hasn't worked any of these attempts. Colin Allred was the last one they tried. They suck. They're not good. I don't think the voters of Texas will go along with it. But there is something to be worried about. This is something I want to also break down for the prediction markets, because when I went into the prediction markets for this particular market, there are two races there, Democrats and Republicans. At that point, it was something like, I think I got, I looked at it and said, where's the value? That's an important question to ask yourself if you're going to invest in prediction markets. It's not always about whether you're going to win for sure. Right. Like I was kind of thinking you know, Paxson would be ahead and probably win the runoff. However, I will say when he was at 84% chance, I did not think he had an 84% chance to win. I thought he had maybe a 60% chance to win, maybe 55, you know, maybe it was 55-45 or 60-40. So the value was actually on Cornyn, even though I didn't think he was necessarily going to win the primary. The same thing with Jasmine Crockett. She was at 26% is where I wound up getting Jasmine Crockett, which you might say, well, that sucks. You lost. Well, not really, because, of course, you know, I wound up winning with Cornyn. And when I say that, it's because I was selling in the high 80s, right? Like, you know, I didn't need to ride it all the way to 100. And kind of honestly, you know, of course, don't want Cornyn to win. But you know, you go from 16 to 80 and you sell at 80, and the other one you go from 26 to zero. But the overall idea is a success. This is one of the things that, you know, probably at least percentage wise, my biggest win maybe ever on prediction markets was the 2016 election, when I did not think Donald Trump was going to win that election, but he had the value. And he was trading at something like 15%. I think I even had Donald Trump at 9% chance to win at one point during that election night. Was able to win with that. Obviously, Trump came back and won that election because, you know, it was insane where the markets were compared to what was a real value. That's something to look for as you go through the prediction markets. And we'll talk about that more, of course, on Predictable. Let me give you a couple more things here. When it comes to midterm fairness, do people believe these elections will even be fair? Americans' confidence in fairness, accuracy of midterm results, declining poll finds. I mean, it is declining, and quickly to give you, it's about 34% down to 24% over the past year or two. You know, look, that's a decline. I mean, it's a notable decline. And the fact that we basically have both sides all the time telling us whenever they lose, the election is fake. That's not a good thing for our society. You might say, but I think this particular election was fake. Of course, it's important to understand whether there were false election results. Certainly important to make sure that people identify themselves correctly and appropriately before they vote. I'm with you on all that stuff. But I will say, not good for our country if every time, like, I mean, what would be the value of watching a sport if every single time the team that lost, you know, they came out and they made this big stink about how they lost the election or they lost the game because of the other side cheated. And that's all it was all the time. You'd have no faith. It'd be not interesting. You wouldn't understand, the results in a way that would be beneficial. I think here we're getting the same situation set up where, look, everyone will deny the Democrats do this. They do it all the time. Every time they lose, they complain like this. They say this election is not real. The president's not legitimate. These are false results. He's trying to manipulate it. And that's why these are changing right now. Democrats are basically saying, well, I don't trust that the Trump administration won't try to steal this election. Why are they thinking that? It's not because Donald Trump said the election in 2020 was stolen. It's because Democrats are saying this is what Donald Trump's going to do. And, the Republicans, I've been very critical of them as well for the way that they've handled a lot of these election results. I just don't think it's beneficial to anybody, honestly. But that's where we are. The hidden reason Republicans could outperform midterm expectations comes from Henry Olson at The Washington Post, who certainly knows this stuff of, veteran data journalist and poll expert. Most commentators and strategists look to one of the many good aggregators that take publicly available polls and use them to construct a job approval index. That is the right way to do it, since any single poll can easily return an outlier finding. However, overall job approval, though commonly and prominently tracked, is not the figure to watch ahead of the midterms. The better indicator is job approval among registered and likely voters. So again, the original one, if you think about the normal poll result you normally see, is what they call adults, right? It's just people who are of age of voting, whether they're going to vote or not. Not important. As we get closer to elections, they start sifting these people out. Well, this guy hasn't voted in 8 straight elections. The chances of him voting in this next one, probably pretty low. Let's toss him out. And we'll keep only the people who have maybe voted regularly or show signs that they're engaged in the process or whatever that is. Every place has a different set of filters to determine this. But coming up with registered voters, that's an easy filter, right? Are you just registered to vote? We're taking out people who aren't even registered. And then likely voters are where you put in the more artistic filters, if you will. And you're trying to say who's really going to vote in this election. When you look at that, this is what Olson points out. Usually those two aren't all that far apart, but right now there is separation. And because of that, the aggregators are currently overestimating Trump's political weakness. And that's just Trump. Of course, the problem with, Trump, if you want to point to one, when it comes to electorally, is that his prominence, his success in elections has not really trickled down that much. His 2024 election win, pretty significant, right? He won all 7 swing states, gave us on the Republican side, if you're a Republican, like a 6-seat margin in the House, a very small margin in the House. There wasn't a lot of trickle down there. A lot of the candidates he's picked haven't done as well, certainly as he has in these elections. And the question has always been, hey, is Donald Trump kind of a unique phenomenon or is there more to it than that? Primaries are coming up right around the corner. We have Illinois. On Tuesday, May 5th, is Indiana, Ohio, Nebraska, West Virginia, May 12th, Louisiana, May 16th, May 19th, you got a bunch, Alabama, Georgia, Idaho, Kentucky, Oregon, and Pennsylvania, and then June 2nd is California and Iowa. The list goes on, Montana, New Mexico, New Jersey, and South Dakota as well on June 2nd. The California one's going to be interesting. That governor race is bizarre. Right? We've talked about it a little bit. Eric Swalwell, the guy who farts on TV and has sex with spies, that guy is in first place, but only by a couple points. Second and third place are two Republicans. There's a chance that two Republicans could advance to the runoff and somehow out of nowhere, California could get a Republican governor because of their weird system. But that's a whole other thing. Illinois, by the way, it is historic, they say, and this is a phenomenon we're seeing all across the country. 2024 election cycle saw all 17 members of Illinois congressional delegation seeking re-election. This year's election has five incumbents that are either retiring or running for another office. The five vacancies are the most Illinois has had in a congressional election cycle in nearly 80 years. Last time was 1948. There was a slew of vacancies. But the issue is all around the country, honestly, there's a slew of vacancies. And that's a big deal because the more vacancies you have, the more unpredictable these elections become because we don't know what these people have. Their baggage isn't out there yet. You just don't know. And of course, there's a major incumbency advantage. So if your candidate sticks in the race, they have a better chance of winning and maybe drawing those people over. By the way, this is what it looks like for balance of power. The favorite is a Democratic sweep of the House and Senate, 48% chance. The Democrats holding the House and are getting the House, but the Republicans holding the Senate is at 40% chance of happening, according to Kalshi. Then you have Republican House, Republican Senate. They hold both at 15% chance. And of course, basically no chance that the Republicans would win the House and the Democrats would win the Senate. The Senate's going to be harder for the Democrats to win. If they win the House, they'll almost definitely win the Senate. And the Senate odds, by the way, getting very interesting, I would say, from a prediction market standpoint and just from an observer standpoint. We have basically a tie, 52% chance for Republicans to hold the Senate, 48% chance for Democrats. That number is, I think, very optimistic for Democrats. We went through the structure of the Senate. They definitely have a chance. I just think the chance is more like maybe 35%, something like that, rather than 48. So there's a gap there that's pretty significant. It might even be less than 35%, honestly. We're talking about Republicans losing in elections, you know, in states like Texas, right? That's the chance that the Democrats have. If Republicans are losing Senate elections in Texas and Ohio is another one, well, then, yeah, Democrats have a real chance to win. But that would, again, be catastrophic territory. OK, I want to talk about a bill that might be catastrophic coming up here in just a second with Daniel Horowitz. He'll join us next. All right, this message is sponsored by Raycon. One thing I've noticed is how often people are listening to something while they go about their day. I'm doing it all the time. Sometimes I think too much, you know, because I'm just like constantly listening to something, constantly prepping for one of these shows. And I do that sometimes with podcasts and audiobooks and, you know, and sometimes just music. I'm just going to town with. It's become part of the routine, whether you're walking the dog, whether you're running errands, or you're just getting a few things done around the house. But traditional earbuds can make you feel a little cut off from the world around you. My solution for this for years has been one ear. Like, I don't want to be all, you know, jammed in and then I've got like, you know, someone says something to me or whatever. I don't hear it. I don't want to be in that cocoon. So I throw one ear in. Well, that kind of sucks. You're getting the ear one side. It's kind of uncomfortable. You're not getting the full sound. That's why Raycon Essential Open Earbuds are such a smart design. Instead of just, you know, sitting inside your ear canal, they rest kind of just outside of it. So if that feeling of something inside your ear you don't really like, I don't really like it all that much, this is much better for you. And you could still hear what you want to hear while also hearing things like, you know, traffic and conversations or maybe someone trying to get your attention. They're lightweight, the flexible ear hook keeps them secure, and they're comfortable enough that you can wear them for hours without thinking about it. Just a really practical way to listen to music or podcasts. This podcast, for example, without turning the world kind of into like this cocoon where you can't hear anything else. Essential Open Earbuds are perfect for refreshing your routine this spring. Go to buyraycon.com/stewopen. Buyraycon.com/stewopen. There, you will get 20% off. It's buyraycon.com/stewopen for 20% off. And of course, thank you to Raycon for sponsoring the program. They say necessity is the mother of invention. I like to say that bipartisanship is the mother of crap. That's just my own. So it hasn't really caught on that much, but a lot of times we all cheer for bipartisanship and then we see it in action. And a lot of times it's not as pretty as we all imagine it to be. I want to bring in Daniel Horowitz. He is a senior editor for Blaze News and host of the Blaze podcast Conservative Review, which you can subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts. His new piece out at the Blaze right now, it's called Data Centers Are a Hidden Tax on Your Burger. So be sure to check that out. I want to talk to him about that in a second. But I want to start, Daniel, if we could, with this new bill, which we see you know, it's I'm seeing it promoted on the right as it's like, oh, gosh, it's this, you know, they're dealing with housing and it's wonderful. And it's, you know, Tim Scott. And then it kind of in the background of all the headlines is, oh, it's also Elizabeth Warren who's bought into this. And just immediately, shouldn't we be terrified of this bill?
I mean, look, we're now at the point where the right is so comatose at a policy level, they could pass an Obamacare magnitude bill overnight. And honestly, our people or the influencers wouldn't care unless the right people get involved. And if those right people would support it, they'd support it, as we're seeing. Well, I'm here to tell you this actually is an Obamacare magnitude level bill for housing. It's not just a matter of, okay, it expands all the HUD, you know, sort of Section 8, community block grant programs that the president promised in every budget to eliminate. And it's, you know, more spending, more subsidies, more HUD involvement when we all believe in abolishing HUD. But there's really a cultural aspect to this that's very important. The crux of it is built upon this erroneous premise that the reason housing is so unaffordable is that we have a supply crisis, when in fact, particularly in red states, we're overbuilt. And that's why prices are starting to come down. They will crash if government doesn't intervene, which it probably will, to prop it up with these affordable housing subsidies to subsidize local governments, NGOs, Acorn, Habitat for Humanity type of left-wing political infrastructure, community activism, local groups to promote Section 8 demographic gerrymandering in our neighborhoods. What the bill does is it, so it doesn't mandate it. It doesn't mandate Section 8, doesn't mandate multi-unit homes. But what it does do is identifies rezoning opportunities to build more construction. Again, in red states, we do not need more construction by and large. And then it has all these incentives for builders and local communities. Now, it would be one thing if every red county in America were represented by someone like Stu. Okay, so then we could assume it wouldn't be used for bad things. But most county governments aren't just rhinos, you know, in the red states, but they're the kryptonite of what really gets them is the land developers. Everyone knows this. And this is why they're serving as conduits for solar, wind, data centers, Section 8, economic development over individual rights, continuity of neighborhood, demographics. That this is the core fight for the heart of red state America. It's this issue. Mm-hmm. And this bill is a nuclear bomb on that because it incentivizes these very politicians that absolutely will take the money to do more Section 8, empower these unscrupulous sort of local NGOs that are not with us to bring in, I think it, the language is expediting permitting of mixed income affordable structures. You know what that means. And now, look, they're attaching Trump's plan to partially limit institutional investors from buying up the homes, which, you know, for the most part, we support. But that's not the crux of the bill. This bill existed actually long before the president brought this idea out. It does have some sort of environmental regulatory easements that Republicans attached in exchange for Elizabeth Warren stuff, which was, by the way, her presidential campaign. But, you know, again, do we have onerous, sometimes zoning laws? Yes. But Stu, my gosh, do you want the federal government to be able to come in? This is what Obama was trying to do with HUD and say, hey, you need some more development in Section 8. Deal with it at your local level. And because there might be a supply choke off in New York and California, that's their problem. I don't think that the one bill that we're going to get through this trifecta in regular order needs to be, oh my gosh, we need to build more houses in California and New York.
It's really interesting. You're correct. I don't want the government involved in any of this stuff, honestly. It is being pitched as this thing where we're going to limit, you know, big companies from building houses just to rent them or buying up houses. I'm less enthused by that approach than a lot of the people on the right are.
I agree with you.
Okay. I just don't like the involvement.
It's a symptom of the problem. Mm. the Trump administration is supporting the cause of the problem while complaining about one of the symptoms. The cause is high prices. Why? Because of the perpetual zero interest rates that he supports, the endless MBS pumping that he supports, not just from the Federal Reserve, but Fannie and Freddie as well. Constantly, and he says himself, he wants prices high for the seniors, but interest rates at zero, which is an impossibility with inflation now. The 10-year note is balking at that. But then, oh my gosh, it's so expensive. Well, what one of the symptoms is, well, then institutional buyers come in and buy them. But not only is it a symptom, it's also a delayed reaction, Stu, because it peaked a couple years ago.
Yeah.
They know what I know. They're selling off because prices are tumbling, particularly in the South, which is overbuilt. It is, there is a record 550,000 more sellers than buyers, according to Redfin. It's about to tumble. It's not a supply problem. And one other thing I got to say about this is, and this is very sad, but it's a reality. In the long run, the boomers own most of the homes. They're dying off. The younger generation, sadly, is godless, familyless. There's no family formation. In the long term, this is not the problem. There's going to be a plethora of housing. We just got to get government out of creating asset bubbles. This bill, the same affordable housing agenda since Bill Clinton, it takes literally all these programs Trump promised to abolish, juices them up. But what I'm telling you is it culturally is going to gerrymander our neighborhoods. And yes, it ties into the data centers. It ties into the flock cameras, the smart cities, the solar, the wind, the carbon capture. We have a multi-frontal assault on red state land, which is the only thing that we control. And it's the only thing God doesn't create more of. If being a conservative is not conserving that land for proper homesteads in accordance with the culture of the community and farms and ranches, then I don't know what it means to be a conservative.
Mm. You mentioned the data center thing. You have a piece up at the Blaze, a big one, and it's about, you know, what I think a factor that most people haven't considered, because land, maybe people have wrapped their heads around this a little bit, these giant data centers coming into communities, maybe that can affect prices in various different ways. But, you know, your argument here is that this is going to hit us in basically everything, even the food that we eat. Can you explain this?
We need a Manhattan Project for what? Do we need a Manhattan Project for cheap and abundant and healthy food and beef at a time when family ranches and farms are going out of business? Everyone recognizes this is a problem. We have farmland being gobbled up because of high land prices, what we just talked about with government pumping and market distortions? Or do we need a Manhattan Project for cloud-based, and I'm being very careful with my language here, I'm not against AI, cloud-based generative AGI, this Zeus-like God general intelligence to create a surveillance state, gather all our data, and then so people could produce these sort of gay, goofy videos and shitify the internet with slop. Which one do we need more of? Yet we're told that every state needs, in West Virginia, they're trying to exempt them from sales, property, and income tax. But a lot of them, they're all exempting them from sales tax. And you know why? Because their crap depreciates within 3 to 5 years. So it's insolvent without government favors, just like green energy. They want special land favors. This is very important. There are times when government is a little bit too, local governments are a little bit too overzealous. But for the most part, what we're dealing with in the here and now is the opposite. If I want to open up a car repair shop on my residential street and you stop me, are you being overbearing and pro-regulation? No, your modality of business, your commerce, your industry has to work in concert with the equilibrium of society we have. If I have a technology that supposedly could do amazing things, but here's the deal, Stu. It's going to gobble up all the farmland. It's going to gobble up all the power. It's going to gobble up all the water. It's going to create tremendous amount of noise. And we need 10 of these hyperscales in every county in America. And then the more cloud we have, the more we have to build. And we don't even have the money for it, but let's build it first and have the government bail us out. Is that free market? No. No, but that is what's happening. And in states like Indiana, it's funny. I don't know if you saw that tornado that destroyed that solar farm. The entire, the 3-1, 4-1 Republican majorities have turned Indiana into a parking lot for economic development, for wind, solar, carbon capture, and data centers, and the flock cameras and the smart cities are the next thing they're going to be working on. I will tell you, as conservatives, the number one thing we need to do is to keep at arm's length the ability of red state America to at least control its sovereign land. You can make those determinations there, but the last thing you want is the federal government shoving this stuff down red state land.
It's a scary thing, and I don't think people have really, really thought about it yet. You know, or we're just still dealing with like.
The people have.
Yeah.
Have you seen the protests?
The people in those areas have. Yeah, for sure.
Our colleagues haven't thought about this because. Yeah. It's not put on the algorithms, but the people know.
I will say, I was listening to an interview with a woman who had a data center put like basically right behind her house, and they just walked out of the backyard, and you can hear just the entire the hum of this thing. And like, look, as you point out, I'm not against AI. We have to be very careful with what we're doing with it. But like, it's also, you got to be careful to make sure you're not ruining people's lives with these data centers. There's no reason to do it that way. We do have space in the United States. If you're careful with these things, you don't need to put them in people's backyards. And certainly don't need to be ruining people's food prices with all this. Daniel Horowitz, Blaze News senior editor. He, of course, does the Blaze podcast that you probably already listened to, but keep listening to it. Conservative Review, wherever you get your podcasts, you can get that there. Be sure to go to theblaze.com as well. Check out the new piece. Data centers are a hidden tax on your burger. Daniel, thanks so much for coming back on the program, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks for your time. Take care.
Well, I've been on a bit of a roller coaster over the past few weeks when it comes to oil prices. They rose to $120 a barrel, and they dropped back down to 80. It's still up like a 30-something percent over before the war started. So we're all over the place, and now they're rising again. Oil prices rising after Iran's new supreme leader said Strait of Hormuz must remain closed, which is interesting. It went up to about $100 a barrel again. It's interesting because, like, was it a surprise? Was anyone like, I don't know. The new Ayatollah, he's the kid of the old one, but I think he just might be pro-Western ideals. What did we think was going to happen here? The question is whether we can stop them from closing the Strait of Hormuz. That's really the question here. Eventually, I think certainly we can, depending on how many resources we want to put toward that problem. But for the moment, as long as they've got missiles to fire and drones to fire, it's going to be very dangerous going through that area. There's no question about that. Iran does seem to be trying really everything they have at their disposal to try to fight back against us. Iran appears to have conducted a significant cyber attack against a U.S. company, a first since the war started. The Iran-linked hacker group has claimed responsibility for a cyber attack on a medical tech company. The company is called Stryker. It is headquartered in Michigan, and it produces a range of medical equipment and technology. So, it might just be a target of opportunity. I don't know that necessarily Stryker is the center of our economy, but they're trying to do whatever they can do. They're launching stuff at, civilians in Arab countries that are now turning against them. This strategy does not seem to be a good one for Iran, honestly, when it comes down to it. They had a chance, perhaps, to try to go towards a more moderate person who would still sort of keep the regime somewhat steady. Because we saw that in Venezuela, right? Like, I don't love the approach in Venezuela, but that's something. It's an approach that Trump is open to, right? If you'll just be sane, we'll probably leave you in there. Of course, they're not choosing that path, probably to their own. They're probably going to create their own series of issues. Let's put it that way. Gene Simmons has some opinions on those who were talking about the war, including Mark Ruffalo. He says celebrities should just shut the F up about it, which is I kind of agree with in every way possible. He says, everyone in the world should listen to what actors and comedians say because they're so qualified. Simmons responded sarcastically before adding a more serious tone. Basically, shut the F up. Do your art and shut up. No one's interested in their opinions. That includes me, who I vote for and who I like. Who the F do you think I am, or who the F do you think they are? As he said. Canada is actually, I would say, maybe the first people who were kind of on that road of telling celebrities to shut the F up was South Park, right? Do we have the South Park? This was a clip from, was this Team America? I can't remember if this is. This is Team America World Police. Here it is. You'll remember this, of course, from back in the day.
What say you, Mr. American Ambassador? Canada.
You, buddy.
So there you go. You remember there was a battle between us and Canada in that movie. We're getting closer and closer and closer to bringing it to reality, finally. Americans' favorability ratings of Canada and Great Britain are going down right now, down to 80% for Canada and down to 76% for Great Britain. This is an all-time low over the past 40 or 50 years. That's not great when you have allies not being seen positively. A lot of this is because of the things they're doing. Some of those are based on things we're doing. You want to keep your allies if you can. You don't have to kiss their butt. You don't have to agree with them on everything, but you'd like to keep them on your side if it's at all possible. Right now, we're going kind of in the wrong direction, but as you see, 76 and 80% still generally positive relations with two of our closest allies. Oscars are Sunday. We might do a pre-show of some sort on the prediction market side. So check out the YouTube channel, youtube.com/studiosamerica for details on that, or predictableshow.com. But I'm not an actual expert on the Oscars by any means. I just looked at it. There's 10 nominees. I've seen one of the 10, which is F1, the only one that actually people saw. But I do have, I think some people have really dove in. One of my producers is like half. He's seen like half of them. And what I will say about that is I said, one battle after another was the big one, a favorite to win Best Picture, 77% chance, Sinners at 20%, and Hamnet at 1%. The question really is, is this any good? Is it a good movie? I would say I have no idea because I didn't see it. But I will say he said, it's good enough, but like, I don't get the hype. And what's the hype? Why is that going to win? I'll tell you why. Because when you have a choice like this between two liberal sort of tropes, you have to understand how to select in the Oscars based on this, because you have Sinners, which is a movie that is basically saying evil white people are exploiting black people through capitalism. So that's the hidden message behind Sinners. Spoiler alert. One battle after another is saying, hey, we should have a violent left-wing revolution against the Trump government. Although I think they don't actually say the Trump government, but they certainly are insinuate it. That's why it's going to win, because that's the vibe. You had to take the current vibe of the crazy left. Can't just take any vibe of the crazy left. Right now, they're much more focused, I would say, on violent revolution than they are on just generic, boring racial issues. So there you go on that one. And then the other one that's interesting, I think, is Timothy Chalamet, who kind of potentially maybe blew his best actor by a dumb interview where he said ballet and opera are stupid. He didn't exactly say that. That's my translation. By the way, a true sentiment. They're both stupid. That being said, he's now the underdog to Michael B. Jordan, who may very well win for, I still think he's a value though, at 40% chance, Timothy Chalamet for the ping pong movie. I mean, if he can make a ping pong movie interesting, he probably should win something. All right, Frontier Magazine back with issue 5. You don't want to miss it. As always, the only way to get Frontier Magazine is through your Blaze Unlimited subscription. It's like a kind of a top tier for the cool kids, okay? For a limited time, first 50 subscribers who use the promo code FRONTIER40 will get $40 off. By the way, make sure you use the code. Like, I keep hearing from people who are like, oh, I subscribe, I didn't put the code in. Use the code FRONTIER40. You're going to save $40 plus digital access to issues 1 through 4. You can follow the entire story from the beginning, blazeunlimited.com/stew. The code is FRONTIER40. And by the way, get the copy of issue 5 only through Blaze Unlimited. We also have the Oscars, as I mentioned, coming up. Kind of a fun way to just do a little preview content before we get the predictableshow.com machine fully up and running. We're like hiring. It's crazy, things are happening behind the scenes. We're only a few weeks away. And then we have, of course, Dave and Stu on the air. Stu and Dave Do America coming on April 1st, I believe, right here on Blaze TV.